This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear about the planned safety audit of I-94, including a long stretch through southwest Michigan. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments sometime this year in a case involving bans on same-sex marriage in four states, including Michigan. We're going to talk with a couple whose future will be impacted by whatever the Supreme Court decides on that issue. Karen Sanborn and Audrey Waringa will be part of a panel discussion on Sunday at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Portage. It's called Understanding the Marriage Equality Issue in Michigan. Karen and Aud, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's begin with just finding a little bit about you. How did you meet?
Well, we met through mutual friends in 1987, and
you were pregnant.
I was 4 months pregnant at the time. I had started my life thinking I would be a single parent, which in retrospect was a little naive, but I was lucky that I met Aud when I was 4 months pregnant, and we got together, maybe 2 months after that. And Aud moved from Grand Haven to Kalamazoo, which is where we had our first house together. And 5 months later, our son was born in October of 1987. So we've been together for 27 years, almost 28.
Aud, do you want to fill in a little more detail for us?
Well, yes. When we first met, it was a year full of life changes, going from being a single person to meeting somebody that you fell head over heels for, and turns out she's pregnant on top of that. So I always like to joke that the Dutch in me just saw it as a two-for-one sale. So I was able to have an immediate family. But changed jobs, changed households, in effect got married, had a child, all in a very short period of time. And never a second thought about it, never a second guess about it. Just moved forward and appreciated, you know, everything that we could share together. After our son was born, neither of us were out to our families at the time. And we were looking for whatever legal protections that we could provide our family. And so probably within about a year of him being born, we contacted an attorney who was gay friendly and worked through everything, you know, that we could legally do at the time to protect our family. And that included medical power of attorney, regular legal power of attorney to be able to sign documents, trust, and a will, of course. I did look up on the Kalamazoo city website, it was the city clerk's website, to find out what a marriage license costs today in Kalamazoo. And for $20, you can get all of those legal protections and more. For us, it was several thousand dollars to obtain the minimal legal protections that we could obtain at that time.
I think that a big concern of ours at that time was, you know, of course, what would happen to our son, Alex, if something happened to me. And that's where we spent most of the money probably at that time.
Yeah, and we still could not guarantee that I would be named the guardian, just based on the laws in the state of, well, probably throughout the country, but in the state of Michigan. We couldn't guarantee that that would happen. So we also had to do additional work with her family and you know, that sort of thing. So
just to go back for just a moment, so we fill in again some more of the details. Karen, you got pregnant with the idea that you would just be a single mom. You didn't count on being part of a couple or...
Well, I was hoping to, and that was my goal. I worked with a lot of kids that came from disadvantaged families, and I figured I would have the wherewithal to be a single parent if I had to. I think I had just reached a point in my life where I decided I wanted to be a parent. And I was just coming out myself at the time, so I had a lot of things to figure out at once. I got lucky and met Aud. It would have been much harder being a single parent. I mean, obviously people do, but it worked out best for us in the long run.
When same-sex marriage has been legalized in other states, have you ever looked at each other and said, why are we here in Michigan? Why don't we move somewhere else where we could legally get married?
Well, we did go, as soon as it was legal throughout all of Canada, We did go to Canada in 2003, and we got married there. So technically, we've been married since August of 2003.
Coming up on 12 years this summer.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. I have joked in the past that, not that this will be a big shocker probably politically, but we took our George W. Bush stimulus checks. If you recall, when those first $300 checks came out to stimulate the economy, we took those checks and we went to Canada and got married and spent the money there.
Certain irony in that, isn't
yes,
there?
And we the angst of it all at that time, you know, we of course said, oh, we should just move to Canada. We should just move to Canada. But of course, we didn't. You know, this is home. This is where we have our roots. This is where extended family is. This is where our community is. And
but if we wanted to get divorced, we would have had to move to Canada and live there for a year.
Yes,
which
we found that found that out after the fact. So neither we always, you know, we just keep an eye on things. If one of us is packing a bag and says something about moving to Canada, then we know we got to work something out. So.
So your son, Alex, is now a grown adult.
Yes, he's 27. If I could just back up one second,
sure,
it was
ahead.
Interesting. I was just thinking about the history of where we've come from. And when we met in 1987, the possibility of gay marriage wasn't even being talked about. And I think at that time, the thing that people were doing were starting commitment ceremonies, which legally didn't mean anything, but emotionally, I think, connected us. We didn't choose to do that, but it's just funny how quickly that's come through our lifetime, and that's sort of course, gone out now, and the focus has changed. The possibility of being legally married never crossed my mind, and I didn't think it was something that would happen in my lifetime.
How much does your marriage in Canada mean legally in the United States or the state of Michigan?
Well, right now it's recognized by the federal government, and it would be recognized in any other state that has same-sex marriage. We, last year for the first time, since it became recognized by the federal government, we had to do our taxes as married. We could never claim that before. So the federal taxes had to be done as married because we are married, but then the state doesn't recognize it. So then the state taxes had to be done as single. I groused about that a little bit, just because the state of Michigan requires you to take the numbers off of the federal form to fill out the state form. And so then I had to do the federal form three times so that I could do the taxes. Just another little blip along the way.
So you mentioned all the legal loopholes and hoops that you were jumping through when it came to your son. Audit, at the end of the day, what legal ties did you have to Alex as he was growing up?
As he was growing up, you know, according to the laws, I really had none. You know, I couldn't be considered a step-parent. We did eventually go through a second parent adoption. And so then, he was 14?
14, yeah.
When I legally became his parent. But prior to that, I had virtually no legal claim, so.
But with that process, we had to have a home study done, just like anybody that's adopting a child. And then I had to give up my parental rights. And he became a ward of the court for 2 minutes. And I had my hand on that paper as I was getting ready to sign the paper that the two of us then adopted him together. So his birth certificate now says parent and parent.
Well, I want to go back through that again. That's interesting. So you had to sign away your parental rights for just a brief moment there in order for the two of you to be able to then go through with this other legal...
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's called a second parent adoption, and I think it's usually used for families that have a stepchild but not a biologic father that's involved, because we had to confirm that there was no biologic father that was involved in Alex's life. And I'm not sure the reason why I had to give it up, but I think it was the fact that they had two parents here that were willing to adopt him and we'd been through the home study, so we'd been okayed. But we did this home study the first time when he was 9 years old. So Aud had already been his parent for this time, and then we had to have the social worker come in and ask him questions about his home life and get a tour of our house, and it was an odd experience.
I mean, you do it. We weren't raising our fist to the sky and railing against the system because we wanted this to work. So we were doing everything that we needed to do in order to make that happen. But looking back on it, we attempted the second parent adoption through an attorney in Kalamazoo, and then that fell through at the last minute. And so when we found out we could do it elsewhere, basically we went through that whole thing again with another home study and another report and filling out all of forms. And of course there's fees involved and all that sort of thing. So,
and it also said that the child had to be present in the county, and we had interpreted that as meaning we had to live in the county. But the judge that worked with us just wanted to recognize that he was in the county when the adoption happened, which wasn't real clear at the beginning.
So, it's been many, many hoops, and I don't want to begrudge the cost involved, but certainly much more expenditure for us to even come close to having the protections that probably you, and I believe you said you had a wife, and if you
and
have
two
kids,
children, yeah.
that just happened, based on a certificate and a birth certificate that, probably your insurance company paid the price for that. So
that was the hardest piece of paper I ever had to sign, though. Here I was giving up the rights to my son to the court, and
even though you knew what was coming eventually.
Yes, though I knew, but it was... That was difficult.
So when somebody questions, I guess, the need for marriage, because I will tell you, some of the politicians I interviewed this past summer who were running for various offices said maybe the government should just get out of marriage altogether. That was one idea I heard. But as people who've been through this, how much difference does it make legally that you can get married?
Well, I've seen the claim that there's over 1,000 rights recognized to a legally married. I've never looked up what those 1,000 are. I just know what impacts us, whether it's being able to cover each other on insurances, whether it's being able to, automatically sign documents for each other without another legal paper that says you can do so. It's, a variety of benefits. We're both retired now, and upon retirement, you have to pick whether your spouse is going to continue to get a benefit if you die. And we couldn't do that because our marriage wasn't recognized. So, you bump up into these things almost constantly, and I think if you're not on this side of the equation, when you bump up into that stuff, as a opposite sex couple, you just don't notice it.
So as people who have been through a lot of different ramifications, I guess, of what it means to not be able to legally marry, and especially when you have a child involved, what do you think about as you're hearing that the Supreme Court is weighing these arguments? And again, your son's grown, but there are lots of couples out there with children. If they've got children who are still minors, I guess, what do you think about them, and how much difference do you think it's going to make in their lives if there is some sort of marriage equality that ultimately comes about either through the Supreme Court case or some other means?
Well, I don't think it's been talked about by a lot of couples or people have thought forward a lot to that yet, but once it becomes legal, then when their children become, they become a step-parent, and they have those rights immediately. And it's not a long discussion of how they will have connections to the children they've been living with already.
So, we don't know all of the legal ramifications of step-parenthood, but at least I'm aware that for insurance coverages and for some other responsibilities, that simply being married to a person with children and you become a step parent, then, you do have some of those avenues that open to you. Whether eventually you adopt those children yourself, I'm not sure how all of that works. But it makes a huge difference for families. And I think, you had asked earlier, well, what if the state gets out of marriage, or what if the government gets out of marriage altogether? And You know, I just have to look that person in the eye and say, how on earth could that ever happen? Because what this boils down to, as far as the government is concerned, is it's a legal contract. It's simply a legal contract between two consenting adults. If the government sees fit to endorse that legal contract or to maintain or uphold, I just don't know how. I would just be baffled. I would just want that person to explain to me, how on earth could that ever happen? Now, certainly, you know, we have never advocated that this should be something that every religious institution should recognize. They should have the freedom to recognize what their beliefs hold. But this, in and of itself, is a legal contract, and, you know, the government oversees that contract, always will.
And I think that it would have some effect on couples that split up. At the moment, no matter how long they've been together, if they do, one of the couple does not have any legal responsibility or accessibility to the child if the biologic parent chooses not to share that. We had some friends that went through that when their child was young, and luckily someone in the community stepped up and said, you can't just take her daughter away. And it was almost like the community was paying attention to what was going on because we didn't have any legal rights for that woman.
So how much do you think your life is going to change if there is a decision from the Supreme Court that does say same-sex marriage is legal in these four states, including Michigan?
Well, you know, again, all of those legal bits and pieces that then fall into place for us, that just makes things easier and more equitable. You know, and we were talking about this because of the upcoming program that we're going to be presenting in. You know, really, what are the, you know, beyond the legal, what are the emotional, what are the social, what are the community aspects of it? And being a part of a society that closes you off from part of what makes that society run, not being given that opportunity to participate in that right or that passage, that recognition, that communal embracement, which is, you know, what a wedding is, as well as a legal matter. It's also making a promise before your community to this other person, and then them in turn promising to hold you to that we're going to support you in this. And so, you know, not having that opportunity, you know, I shoved it aside and said, well, that's not important. You know, what's important is, you know, we have each other, we're committed, we know we'll be together for the rest of our lives. You know, none of that is important. And I truly believed that until we got married. And we were standing there exchanging vows, and it just hit me upside the head. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is what this is. And it actually gave me a much better perspective beyond that. You know, when we went to my nephew's wedding, you know, a few months later, it's like, it just gave me a whole new outlook. It gave me a whole new, it just was eye-opening. And so I think, you know, set aside all the legal stuff, just the idea that we can then be full participants in the societal expectations, the norms, the recognition, the support, the community. I think that's a huge thing. But that's all on a very personal level.
But personal is an important part of this, right?
I think the Supreme Court, you have to argue all the legal stuff. But from a humanitarian standpoint, I think you have to understand, you know, what that takes away from your community when you deny that.
Kieran, did you have more thoughts?
Well, I think life has always been about fairness for me. And when I see injustices, that sort of pushes my button. And I had never really thought about that until we did get married. And it did mean a lot to me. but it also made me a little bit more angry at society for not recognizing this. I mean, we had shared this and it was important to us, but it didn't mean as much. It was just hard for watching other couples go through and talking about their weddings at work and everything they were planning and how excited they were, and not having the ability to share that with everyone was hard.
Aud and Karen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Audrey Waringa and Karen Sanborn will be part of a panel discussion on Sunday called Understanding the Marriage Equality Issue in Michigan. That will be held at the Unitarian Universalist Church, which is on Shaver Road in Portage. You can find more details at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Michigan Department of Transportation has authorized a road safety audit on a long stretch of I-94. It includes the scene of a massive pileup in January that involved 133 vehicles in Kalamazoo County. The highway was closed for most of the weekend. One person was killed, and another 22 people were injured in the accident. Nick Shiripa is spokesman for MDOT's Southwest Regional Office. Nick Shiripa, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Gordon.
What happens when MDOT conducts a road safety audit?
We're going to look at, it's not going to be just MDOT. In this case, we're going to partner with the Michigan State Police at a bare minimum. And we will look at traffic operations, roadway geometry, law enforcement activity, crash history, and related weather conditions as well, to really get a better idea of what's happening on I-94 from the Indiana state line to U.S. 27 in Jackson County. So roughly 160 or so miles of I-94.
How often is a study like this done?
We do safety audits with some degree of frequency, but they're usually in much more finite locations, much more constrained areas. So a particular intersection maybe where we're looking for signalization or signalization upgrades, or a stretch of road, maybe 1/20th, maybe 1/10th of a mile long of trunk line where there have been recent problems or where we could find some safety innovation there. So we've done them frequently with some degree of frequency in shorter areas and in more small pinpoint locations. But to my knowledge, this is the first such review we've done of such a long stretch of trunk line of any kind, let alone of something as heavily trafficked as I-94.
Will the study perhaps also include the history of the stretch of road here? For instance, you know, the number of accidents, the types of accidents which have happened over, you know, the last year, several years?
Certainly. We'll work with the Michigan State Police on the crash history. They really compile that information. Crash history, crash data, that's really their bailiwick. So we'll tap into them and their UD-10s, their reports on all those crashes. But we'll also delve into weather history. We'll delve into, like I said, road geometry and traffic operations. So we'll bring in experts on driver behavior, climatology, incident management. So we're really going to reach out beyond just MDOT and MSP to bring in some experts.
Weather history might tell us if, for instance, a stretch of road is fine in July and not so good in January?
Yeah, I think weather history is going to give us a better idea. You know, we all know what lake effect storms are like. Anybody who's lived in West Michigan for any amount of time knows that it can be sunny and clear one minute, and then you drive into a curtain of snow and you're in a whiteout. That may only last a mile, but it's there and it came out of nowhere. So we really want to get a better handle on kind of all facets of what it's like to travel on I-94 in Southwest, South Central Michigan. So that's going to include weather. We're going to have to get those experts and that data that tells us what kind of weather events are likely to happen, and then kind of combine that with police reports and all that other information just to kind of see how all that stuff plays together. I don't think it's going to be trying to pinpoint one thing over another, but see how all these facets of traveling on I-94 really interplay for the whole experience, for the whole if it's a challenge or what it was, where is it easier and where does it make more sense? So really the big picture is what we're looking for here.
As you noted, this is a big stretch of highway that's being looked at here, and certainly lake effect snow is a bigger factor at the western end than it would be, say, at the eastern end. So would there be perhaps some breakdown here of the highway where some areas are have different challenges than others have?
Sure. We certainly are going to include detailed reviews on segments of the I-94 corridor that have exhibited some incident concentrations or some areas of crash concentration, such as that section of I-94 really between Sprinkle Road in Kalamazoo all the way out to Helmer Road in Battle Creek. It's not going to be anything real small, real finite. It'll a few miles there. There's also another stretch in Van Buren County from Paw Paw West to Watervliet-ish. So there are a couple areas, a couple not necessarily short stretches, but a couple of stretches within that longer piece that there will be some concentration there. We'll do a little bit more digging there because we know we've had a history.
Who are the actual researchers here that work on something like this? Do they work for the state? Do you bring in people from a university? How does that work out?
I imagine there certainly are going to be some of our operations staff, a lot of our engineers, not a lot, a few of our engineers from different bureaus, different groups within the agency. But, yeah, I can't imagine we won't engage. Obviously, the Michigan State Police will have crash experts, crash reconstruction, driver behavior experts. We'll engage maybe the National Weather Service or NOAA for the weather piece of it, the climatology piece of it. We'll look to emergency response groups for incident management, ideas and expertise. I certainly can see a reasonable going to maybe University of Michigan or Western Michigan University or any other university within our state. That may have some expertise to lend. I don't think we're gonna contain this to an MDOT review by any stretch. We may be kind of leading it up because it's our trunk line, but I think we're going to engage a pretty wide base of expertise so we get a really clear big picture with good sound data and best practices from many disciplines involved.
So when the audit is completed, what happens to that report?
My understanding, once that safety audit, that safety review is completed, the group, however big that may be, obviously led by MDOT, will come up with recommendations for both immediate and longer-term solutions or ideas. Some of those immediate ideas, if you look at rumble strips, shoulder corrugation, centerline corrugation, rumble strips, that's a pretty easy, quick fix. Same thing with guardrail. Pretty easy, little longer than quick fix. But then you're looking at longer-term solutions as well. Whether it's rebuilding a bridge, redesigning a stretch of roadway. There are going to be lots of options, I think, on the table to look at, but I think it's the selection of those longer-term solutions really will hinge on viability and expense. I mean, this is all going to carry a cost with it.
And can you give us the timeline for this road safety audit?
What I'm hearing coming from the folks in Lansing, we're looking at maybe 6 months-ish, give or take. That's kind of what we're suspecting as of now. No formal group or timeline has been put together yet. I imagine as those things come together, we will share all that information with the public and with anybody who's interested, keep them in the loop of that, again, as it comes together.
Nick Sciarrapa, thank you for your time.
Gordon, the pleasure is all mine.
Nick Sciarrapa is spokesman for the Michigan Department of Transportation's Southwest Regional Office. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.